It's extremely common now for media studies professors to violate the Digital Money and Copyright Act because they need to teach effectively. That may be...
To what degree might we be violating fair use if we became the de facto publisher of that material because we were the...
What we found is that filmmakers were in the grips of something we call in one of our reports the clearance culture.
Modern copyright law hasn't really addressed what educators are supposed to do and how they can make use of digital media. Instead, they're working...
As the world has changed, as public broadcasters have evolved over the last 20 years or 30 years, the original television transmission represents only a portion of our effort to produce and distribute. And even more so...
Until there's a real overhaul of copyright law that reflects the need for this kind of use in an educational environment, we're always going to be struggling with a lot of the same problems that we've had from the beginning.
The Digital Learning Challenge, Obstacles to Educational Uses of Content in the Digital Age, a project and white paper from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. The paper's co-authors are Professor William W. Fisher III and Berkman Fellow William McGovern. This foundational white paper reports on a year-long study by the Berkman Center and funded by a grant from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. The paper explores the relationship between copyright law and education, in particular, whether innovative uses of digital technology were hampered by the restrictions of copyright. The paper builds on four detailed case studies: the problems teachers confront when they share classroom materials with third-party content, the need of film studies professors to bypass encryption on DVDs in order to show selected film clips to their students, an ongoing effort to create a digital database of hard-to-find but important American music to college campuses, and the challenges facing public broadcasters as new technologies outpace copyright law. In this Audio Berkman podcast, we'll take a closer look at these and other issues found in the white paper, The Digital Learning Challenge. Audio Berkman is a production of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. For Audio Berkman, I'm Amanda Mickle. For an overview of the project and the white paper, I spoke with Professor William Fisher, the Hale and Dorr Professor of Intellectual Property Law at Harvard and the Faculty Director for the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, about how this project was related to the Berkman Center's mission.
Well, the Berkman Center's overall mission is to explore the relationship between technological developments, the legal system, and various aspects of the public interest. When I say explore, that means to study, to examine the relationships among these different factors. But also, we are an activist organization that draws us naturally into recommending or, in some instances, actually building institutions that will address problems that we identify. So the way in which this particular project fits into that overall mission is that the technological setting of education, broadly defined, has been changing rapidly in recent years in ways that are probably familiar to most people. The set of resources, educational resources available in digital form has exploded, and the machinery in the broad sense for gaining access to and manipulating those resources has also expanded radically, with the important caveat that it's this stuff is not yet available equally to all sectors of the population. There's always an issue, and almost arises in almost every dimension of our work, involving the relationship between access to media and wealth. But with that major reservation, the technological opportunities relevant to education have grown extremely rapidly and are continuing to grow. Many teachers at all levels of the educational system, from grammar school all the way through graduate school, are increasingly now relying on digital materials to provide either assigned readings or supplementary reading to their students. technologically, this is very easy to do. That's one of its wonders. It's convenient, flexible, and fast. But it implicates much more than did the clumsier systems of paper distribution copyright questions. So the way in which the copyright system helps or hurts education is immediately apparent, or immediately is raised by the availability or lack of availability of digital materials for assigned readings. Another example of a more specialized circumstance that presents in sharp relief more particular issues is when teachers of film studies or media studies want to take the objects of their subject, which is film or other audiovisual presentations, and take advantage of new techniques for presenting those to their classes. Now, this is different from the usual situation in which most courses are not actually studying the book as an object. Books are just a mechanism for conveying information about the real subject. But in media studies, the thing you are studying is the film. So there's an especially strong argument there for enabling teachers to gain access to specifically unencrypted digital versions of their films in order to conveniently show clips, incorporate portions in lectures, enabling the students to incorporate portions in papers and so forth. Again, this triggers a legal issue.
The problem that Professor Fisher mentions, that copyright challenges the educational uses of digital content, is the central focus of the digital learning challenge. Most of today's copyright provisions were designed for a world in which digital technologies did not exist. Each day, new technologies hit the market, many of which could be very useful to today's educators. The Digital Learning Challenge paper examines four instances in which educators, public broadcasters, and music publishers have had to maneuver their way around copyright in order to make use of existing digital technologies. Berkman Fellow Bill McGovern was the project leader for the Digital Learning Challenge. We asked Bill to give us an overview of the project.
We wanted case studies that showed different aspects of the broad array of problems that educators face. And educators can be everyone from teachers in front of a classroom to smart people who put up a website that's meant to tell others about their knowledge. So the case studies we selected, there are four of them, are meant to think of education really broadly.
The first case featured in the paper looks at how copyright law hampers teachers' sharing of educational resources. The Center for History and New Media is developing a history teacher networking project, which the white paper describes as a social networking tool for elementary and secondary school teachers for communicating and providing mutual professional support.
The Center for History and New Media had this neat idea to set up essentially a peer-to-peer and social networking system for new teachers to share ideas and swap resources. But they ran up against this copyright problem that even though it was okay for everybody to show these resources in their individual classrooms, it wasn't okay for them to get together and trade and share those resources. Every teacher would be on their own.
Mills Kelly is the associate director for the Center for History and New Media and has been involved in developing the social networking tool for teachers.
Teachers really, especially younger teachers, really struggle to find lesson plans, learning activities with their students that will work and work well, as opposed to just providing them with one more set of names and dates to memorize. Talking with some of the folks I work with in the center and about social networking projects like Facebook and MySpace and Friendster and all of these various things that we're familiar with, and I got to thinking, well, this is kind of a perfect thing to do for teachers, especially younger teachers, many of whom will have been part of the Facebook, MySpace generation when they graduate from college, really as a way for them to train lesson plans, mm-hmm. assignments, tests, various kinds of teaching resources that they might have developed, and do so easily and create a database that anyone could search through and really provide them with the resources that they need as beginning teachers.
I was curious to learn from Mills what role copyright law played in the development of the project.
If you have any familiarity at all with K-12 education, you'll know that PowerPoint is one of the most ubiquitous ways that teachers create lesson materials for their students. And one of the things that we know that they're going to want to share with each other is their PowerPoint presentations. And the thing about that is that those PowerPoint presentations will often include copyrighted material. And so then the question is, what for us was, to what degree might we be violating fair use if we became the de facto publisher of that material because we were the people who had put up this database and were maintaining it?
Bill McGevern explains that the Center for History and New Media has had to curtail plans for the project because of its risks of secondary liability for copyright infringement.
This is another example where the law is grounded in old technology. There's a provision of the copyright law concerning face-to-face teaching, which is pretty much keyed to the world of film strips or slideshows where the soundtrack goes beep and some volunteer from the class has to advance to the next slide. So I remember that equipment from when I was in second or third grade, but that is not the kind of audiovisual presentation we hope to have in most classrooms in the 21st century. But the law is less flexible.
To protect itself from secondary liability, the center placed warnings on the site, urging its users not to upload copywritten material. But at the same time, Mills explains, the center worried that warning would unnecessarily deter teachers from sharing their materials.
And so we were really worried about both as kind of a legal problem for us, but also as a chilling effect on the users themselves.
The paper explains that the Center for History and New Media still plans to include a lesson swapping function in its network, but it will forbid users from sharing any copyrighted material and will present a warning at the upload point.
Of course, we'll take down anything that anyone complains about. This is our standard policy in our center, is that if a copyright holder contacts us and says, you've placed some of my copyrighted material online, take it down. We take it down. We then investigate whether we feel like we've violated fair use or not. And if we feel that we haven't, we put it back up and communicate with the copyright holder on that basis.
The Center for History and New Media decided to move forward with a more limited version of its original plans. The paper contends that far from assisting efforts to help teachers harness the power of digital technology, copyright law stood in its way.
We started out looking specifically at film studies professors because they're in a very interesting bind.
That's Jackie Harlow, a recent Harvard Law School graduate and a student fellow at the Berkman Center. Over this past year, Jackie worked with Bill McGevern and Professor Fisher on the Digital Learning Challenge.
You have a situation where new technologies have emerged, in particular DVDs, and those technologies are such a much better media for film studies professors to use in the classroom. However, to make use of those technologies, they actually need to be able to excerpt just small clips from those DVDs and create compilation discs. And so, unfortunately, that conflicts with copyright law and with the DMCA in particular.
The DMCA, or Digital Millennium Copyright Act, sought to forbid the circumvention of copyright prevention technologies. One such technology used on DVDs is an encryption method known as CSS, or Content Scramble System. Professor Fisher explains that CSS helps to curb unauthorized reproduction and distribution of DVD copies.
There's a good social reason for having this protection, at least within our current model of distributing films.
But for film studies professors, CSS comes at a cost.
It prevents professors from moving smoothly around a film to find and present to the classes the excerpts relevant to what they want to present, and then lifting those excerpts out and incorporating them in critical commentary.
The best way to frame it is to think of how film studies professors used to do their job. And what they used to do is they used to get VHS tapes or 16 millimeter film, But VHS is probably the best example to give because it's the most analogous to the DVD situation. So in an analog world, it's perfectly legal for a film studies professor to take a number of VHS tapes and create one tape with clips from all of those tapes. There's no problem with that because the fair use exception should cover it and the in-class teaching exception should cover it because the professor isn't doing this to make a profit or, you know, to copy the full work. They're just taking small excerpts for teaching purposes.
But with DVDs, the paper explains that film professors have been forced to find their ways around copy protection technologies like CSS, having the bizarre side effect of turning film scholars into outlaws.
It's extremely common now for media studies professors to violate the Digital Millennium and Copyright Act because they need to teach effectively. That may be functional in the sense of the owners of the copyrights in the films have not as yet gone after them and probably will not go after them in the future because it's small potatoes, the impairment of their revenues, and because it's pretty bad public relations to bring suits against film studies teachers who are plainly engaged in a socially beneficial activity.
And as Jackie Harlow explains,
that's why you have this tension where modern copyright law hasn't really addressed what educators are supposed to do and how they can make use of digital media. Instead, they're working in the shadow of the law where they're trying to use a new media in a way that was previously legal but isn't anymore.
The Digital Learning Challenge also investigates some of the practical difficulties nonprofits face when licenses are required to use and distribute content, particularly for nonprofit record labels like New World Records. New World Records is a project of the Database of Recorded American Music, a Mellon-funded online subscription service of scholarly music available to university libraries. To get a better sense of these issues, I spoke to Lisa Colden. As director of the Database of Recorded American Music, she also works with New World Records.
New World Records was founded in, I believe, 1974 as a bicentennial project that was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation initially. It was designed to create a 100 LP series documenting the history of America through its music. The company itself began as a sort of, you know, a project with a very specific kind of mission. Since that time, after the initial release of the 100 LPs, New World continued, and its mission as a record label is to put out recordings that are neglected by the commercial labels. Essentially, American composers who have no outlet in the commercial world find a home here. It's sort of the equivalent of a university press for recording labels.
New World Records is committed to the idea that digital delivery is the future for music. But as music has become more available on the internet, the law has made it more difficult for non-commercial uses of digital distribution. I asked Lisa about the problems New World Records faced when trying to put its music into a database.
The database relies primarily on streaming as its delivery technology. And what we found is because there just is no provision in copyright law specifically covering this, what we had to do was go back to every music publisher who has some kind of copyright over the material and essentially request that they sign an agreement with us to participate in the project. Tracking all these people down was, for New World Records, not so difficult because, you know, we already pay royalty for the physical discs that we sell. But as we expanded past the New World Records catalog, it got trickier as we added new labels to the database. But by any measure, the rights clearance process has been the most complicated.
The law around what's sometimes called digital delivery is very, very muddled and confused.
Berkman Fellow William McGovern.
There's situations that we chronicle in the case study where more than one rights holder think that they're the one that ought to be paid for New World Records to be able to do exactly the same thing. There's other situations where everyone agrees that a particular rights holder ought to be paid and that there will probably be what's called a compulsory license, that is to say a special a set rate that you'd have to pay, but they can't agree on what that rate is going to be or how it's going to be calculated. So there's many, many complicated legal issues.
Lisa says that New World Records has been able to overcome some of these problems through developing an application that keeps track of the physical disc sales online. But for New World Records, this means that they still do not know how much they are going to have to ultimately pay for each of the streams in their database. When asked about how the copyright system is satisfying the overall needs of her organization, she had this to say.
Well, it certainly isn't very forward-thinking from our point of view, in the sense that, you know, it would, for example, be a lot easier for us to, talking about the original set of 100 LPs that New World Records put out. For example, those are still essentially used in a lot of classrooms for instructional purposes, and we would love to be able to clear the rights to those and make them available through the database of Recorded American Music, so we're really impeded in a lot of ways from continuing the original mission of the organization.
WGBH Boston is a member of the Public Broadcasting Service. It produces one-third of PBS's primetime content and is responsible for some of the most well-known and widely viewed PBS programming, such as Frontline, American Experience, and Nova. WGBH is also one of the largest contributors of content on the PBS.org website. The fourth case study in the Digital Learning Challenge takes a closer look at WGBH's efforts to use the internet as a platform for distribution and sharing access to knowledge. I spoke with Jay Fialkoff, legal counsel at WGBH, to further investigate the copyright law and its impact on WGBH. When asked how copyright law seeks to strike a balance between content producers and educational outlets like WGBH, here's what Jay had to say.
The copyright law provides, you know, for public policy purposes, certain exclusive rights to copyright owners. And then, and that recognizes the need to have an economic incentive to create. And at the same time, it puts some limitations on those exclusive rights in order to address the public policy that people should have access to these works once they're created to serve useful purposes. And when the copyright law was passed, there were a variety of, I suppose, political negotiations that went on, intending to balance these sometimes competing concerns. And some of the provisions in the copyright law relate specifically to public broadcasting, as they intended to sort of address, on the one hand, the rights of copyright holders, and at the same time address some reasonable and legitimate interests of public broadcasters in terms of having access to works, given the special, you know, financial circumstances that public broadcasters operate under.
Jay explained that the 1976 law had several provisions that gave PBS stations like WGBH certain automatic rights. One of these included the right to use sound recordings without requiring them to do the additional legwork of securing permission from the copyright owner.
But over time, it reached the point where all of our programs were produced for videos and DVDs. It was an essential element of our distribution in order to serve our mission, and everyone involved wanted broad distribution. And so as a practical matter, although we had an automatic right, we had still the obligation to negotiate and obtain this permission for this other use. And so it reduced what was a good purpose, but it reduced the value of that automatic right. As the world has changed, as public broadcasters have evolved over the last 20 years or 30 years, where the original television transmission represents only a portion of our effort to produce and distribute, and even more so as we go into a digital on-demand environment, these laws need to be clarified and updated, we think, in order to fulfill their original purpose of balancing the interests in copyright holders. We respect the rights of copyright holders. We produce copyrights here, and we spend our days acquiring rights from people who own them, you know, and we don't want to take anything away from them. We just want to come up with a system that fairly addresses everybody's reasonable concerns.
As part of its mission, WGBH clearly has an educational focus. I asked Jay to specifically explain how copyright has limited WGBH's educational efforts.
First, to the extent that we are unable to get the rights to use the ideal creative elements, whether it be a photograph or a song or whatever, because they're either unavailable or too costly, we all suffer if we're looking to make the best possible project. Beyond that, if rights, are being held out as being too expensive, it can impact the overall quality of a program. It gets more complicated when we talk about, sometimes derivative uses. For example, GBH is on the forefront of trying to come up with systems for, distributing educationally the materials that we produce so that they are as valuable as possible for teachers and schools. And we've created over the last several years a website called Teachers Domain, which is intended to, support teachers by having clips from programs we've produced, such as NOVA or American Experience, that are tied into the particular curriculum. Because I think teachers have learned that students don't necessarily want to watch an hour documentary, but 5 minutes at the right time in the right moment might be perfect. And so we've made an effort to do that. And as a practical matter, and I don't know that this is a failure of the copyright law, but it is a reality, it's generally hard to get rights up front so that if an element is used in one of our documentaries, say an American Experience, we would automatically have the right to take a portion of that and then use it for what is obviously a non-profit educational purpose. There's an area where the rights to make derivative uses can be a restraining factor in terms of our educational efforts.
The Digital Learning Challenge deals primarily with the difficulties that occur when new technology meets outdated copyright law. That's one approach to the problem. The other is to educate teachers and stakeholders about the law. With limited resources in just 1 year, the Center for Social Media was able to produce a statement of best practices aimed at documentary filmmakers. The statement elaborates on the four factors in the statutory test and applies the doctrine to everyday situations that documentarians often face. We talked with Peter Yazzie, professor of the Washington School of Law, about his work with Pat Alfterheide, the executive director at the Center for Social Media. The two of them have worked extensively to better understand how documentary filmmakers experience copyright law.
When we went around and talked to a lot of filmmakers, one of the things we discovered is that for many of them, copyright law is much more of a problem than it is a benefit. And their reasons were simple, that in order to do the projects that they want to do that they think are important, they need to make use of a lot of pre-existing material that is, in this moment of expansive copyright protection, subject to someone else's rights. And that could be archival footage, or it could be music or images that appear in the background of a cinema verite sequence, or it could be media clips that the filmmakers actually want to quote in order to hold them up for commentary and critique. One way or another, what we found is that filmmakers were in the grips of something we call in one of our reports the clearance culture.
From these interviews emerged the documentary filmmakers' best practices in fair use. The initiative serves two related purposes. First, it provides more practical assistance to filmmakers, helping them to determine whether a particular use of content qualifies as fair use. Second, the statement serves as the nucleus of a set of customary practices that over time can help guide courts in determining what types of use are generally accepted as fair within the documentary film community. If the norms in the statement of best practices become widely shared, they could influence judicial outcomes profoundly.
It affected filmmakers by giving them for the first time a clear, usable idea of what their own professional consensus around appropriate use of pre-existing copyrighted materials was. This was a topic about which filmmakers hadn't been talking with one another.
Professors Yazzie and Alfterheide discovered that the filmmakers were familiar with the fair use doctrine in copyright law, but didn't find it meaningful. The filmmakers said it was too narrow in its scope and too unclear in its coverage. I asked Professor Yazzie whether he thinks copyright law is too outdated to deal with new technologies.
That, I must say, is an argument that I don't understand. In other words, I think it's pretty clear that that fair use analysis is not platform dependent, and that although the proliferation of new technologies may raise the stakes to some extent and may proliferate the number of instances in which it may be necessary for someone to rely on fair use. To give an example from the Berkman study, for example, there's that fascinating case study about the history teachers, the high school history teachers, who want to be able to exchange curricular materials. Now, presumably, that has always taken place below the radar to a certain extent. In other words, two teachers meet at a conference, and one of them hands over a bunch of photocopied pages that they've been using in their class, and the other teacher goes home and perhaps adopts some of that in his or her own classroom. And because that has all occurred below the radar at a fairly small scale, legal analysis has really been beside the point in those cases. People have simply done these things as a matter of general practice without worrying about it. The problem with doing them on a web-based platform is that the scale of the exchange is going to be greater, and the visibility of the exchange is going to be greater as well. So I don't actually think that fair use applies differently if the platform for information exchange is handing over some photocopied pages at a meeting or putting something up on a common website, but it becomes more important in the latter setting. And this point is really a very significant one, because the platform independence of doctrines like fair use is an essential part of their strength, their potential potency as a tool for educators. Because they aren't media or platform specific, they are capable, doctrines like fair use in particular, of being adapted to, of evolving with changes in technology, changes that we're already seeing and changes that we probably can't even guess at yet.
The Digital Learning Challenge explains that while its primary task was to identify some of the obstacles to educational uses of content in the digital age, the paper also offers certain paths toward reform that might improve the situation. It suggests that certain types of legal reform, technological improvements in the rights clearance process, educator agreement on best practices, and increased use of open access distribution, all of those things would help minimize the obstacles identified. We asked each of our guests what they see as possible remedies. We first spoke with Professor Fisher, the principal investigator on the project.
So at one end of the spectrum would be legislative change, the adoption of a new provision or two, or a modification of existing provisions of the copyright statute. So there's stuff of this sort ongoing, efforts to revise the portions of the copyright statute dealing with libraries and archiving and orphan works and so forth, all involve traditional law reform of that sort. Right, that would be context number one. Context number two would involve encouraging efforts by other agencies of the government, meaning non-legislative agencies, to exercise or expand their discretion to apply the law more sensitively to copyright questions that implicate education. The premier example is the Fair Use Doctrine, Section 107, which has, throughout its almost 200-year history now, been administered and shaped and adjusted by the judiciary, not by the legislature, and adjusted by individual courts confronting individual cases. It is therefore potentially much more flexible than statutory provisions. So a second way in which we might secure an improvement in the law would be not to get Congress to change the copyright statute, but instead to persuade courts to be more sensitive to the complex needs of education when administering the fair use doctrine. All right, that's context number two. Context number three would involve educating institutions in the entitlements they already enjoy under the legal system as it currently stands. It turns out that there's a big gap between what the law is in this area and the understanding of it by critical players, publishers, for example, or, say, in the documentary film context, the suppliers of errors and omission insurance, have operated for quite some time on the basis of an understanding of the privileges of commentary that are much narrower than the law actually affords. So this doesn't involve law reform, strictly speaking. It just involves bringing people up to speed concerning opportunities that already exist under the current legal doctrines to pursue educational projects. So those would be three quite different ways of approaching solutions. I am moderately hopeful on the first front. Only moderately, because the history of legislative reform is spotty. I'm quite hopeful on the second. The judiciary has proven, with some backsteps, but for the most part has proven a good deal more shrewd, sensitive, in adjusting copyright law when necessary to deal with changing technologies and social needs, in part because they're presented with real cases in which those needs are made visible. And I'm very hopeful on the last front. One of the most important functions of this project is to facilitate already ongoing efforts by other organizations and to start some new efforts of our own to let people know what opportunities already exist within the legal system for pursuing educational ventures.
This is still an area where there's a lot of work that needs to happen for people to think about what are the best ways to move forward.
Berkman Fellow William McGovern.
So we call them paths toward reform as a way of signaling that we don't think this paper is the last word on what we should do. Instead, it's the first word, diagnosing some of the problems and trying to suggest some routes that we might take to fixing them. We did talk about some of the legal rules that could be changed, amended by Congress, or interpreted differently by courts so that they would respond better to the needs of 21st century education. We also talked about the ways that technology could actually help in the rights clearance process. Right now, when you need to clear rights, the way that New World Records needed to clear rights for using material in new and different ways, it can be a very time-consuming process where you have to write snail mail letters and track down many different individual rights holders. But there are already out there in the market some moves towards technology, databases and online resources that would help you find and contact those kinds of rights holders in a more efficient way, and even intermediaries where they collect a big portfolio of all different kinds of rights and let you online ask permission and get automatic permission for a particular price. So when you do need permission, and of course if you have fair use rights or other kinds of exceptions that apply, you don't need permission. But when you do need to get a license and permission to use content, technology may be able to help you do that if we develop that technology the right way. So we talk about legal reform and we talk about new technology. We talk about more open distribution of content through Creative Commons and open access and lots of other sort of copyleft ways of distributing content without so many copyright encumbrances, where the authors and the creators choose to to allow educators to use them. And if that becomes more widespread, obviously educators will have more choice of content that they can use.
There are plenty of needs for statutory reform.
Peter Yazzie.
There are plenty of needs to deal with a range of other issues that the Berkman report addresses. But I think that the potential of fair use as a solvent for many of, not all by any means, but many of the pressing problems of educators seeking to make use of new digital technology is terrific and is only beginning to be realized. Even in the absence of this effort, quite on their own, courts are making a tremendous amount of progress in identifying the appropriate scope, and by that I mean a broad scope, of fair use in cases involving what is so-called, what is often called transformative use of copyrighted works. And there is a string of recent cases, the most recent of which is the Bill Graham Archives decision in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which suggest that the courts are open for persuasive arguments about why socially and culturally positive practices, such as the educational practices involved here, ought to be shielded from liability under the doctrine of fair use. So yes, I think that for all kinds of reasons, there is a lot to be optimistic about here.
I asked Mills Kelly from the Center for History and New Media if Creative Commons licenses were a possible solution to the problems they experience at the History Teacher Networking Project.
The Center for History and New Media is very dedicated to the open source, open access movement. Everything that we do is a free service. We have no fee-for-service activities. And so for us, adopting a Creative Commons approach is just kind of natural. And so it fits with our general mission.
For example, a teacher may create a presentation incorporating material that, while not in the public domain, can now carry the permission of the rights holder, allowing others to copy and distribute it for educational purpose. As Mills describes here, educators use materials licensed under Creative Commons licensing without a problem.
All of the professors I talked to said that they ignore the law.
Jackie Harlow.
There was one professor I talked to who said that he dared the studios to come after him, and it's true because it would be a publicity nightmare. You have professors, they're not copying the movies, they're copying short clips, but they're not giving them away. There's no risk of piracy. They're just trying to teach.
While the paper does not endorse this solution, it has found that in this instance, however, the benefits are realized only by breaking the law. The paper recommends that there should be no penalty under the DMCA when DRM systems are circumvented purely to enable uses of content that are educational, legally permitted, and non-commercial. Further examples are provided in the paper. In the case of New World Records, the paper recommends a number of options to help ease the current difficulty of the rights clearance process, including greater reliance on technology to help users analyze the need to secure licenses for using content and to assist with such rights clearance where necessary. The paper also recommends that there is a need to update the provisions for public broadcasters. As Jay Fialkov at WGBH says,
the copyright law, needs to be adjusted, that's all, to reflect these developments. With regard to public broadcasters, we really think, just a few minor changes can be important. Maybe other people don't view them as minor. But we do think that, the automatic right to use sound recordings should be clarified and perhaps expanded slightly to cover our website and other educational uses. We think that the compulsory license with regard to compositions should be, broadened to cover all of the uses that are, at the core of what public media is these days. There I think could be a very valuable amendment to the fair use damages sections of the copyright law. Now there's a provision in Section 504 that puts limits on the damages that a public broadcaster would incur if they make a reasonable, in their view, decision on fair use. But it relates only to literary materials, and so it really should be expanded to cover other creative elements where we make reasonable calculations concerning fair use.
In this Audio Berkman podcast, we examine the problems teachers confront when they share classroom materials with third-party content. The need of film studies professors to bypass encryption on DVDs in order to show selected film clips to their students. an ongoing effort to create a digital database of hard-to-find but important American music to college campuses and students, and the challenges facing public broadcasters as new technologies outpace copyright law. The paper also offers certain paths toward reform that might improve the situation. The Digital Learning Challenge is available on the web at cyber.law.harvard.edu/home/2006-09. A production of Audio Berkman, you can find this podcast and more at cyber.law.harvard.edu. Just click on podcast. The Digital Learning Challenge was produced and recorded by Colin Reinsmith and Amanda Mickle. For Audio Berkman, I'm Amanda Mickle.